Miami-Dade voters will fill a commission seat, one that hasn't been open for almost 20 years. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Tomorrow, voters in Miami-Dade's District 5 will choose the next commissioner to fill that seat. We're going to talk about the four candidates and how they're going to shape the commission moving forward on many issues. Plus, Hondurans living under temporary protected status now have a deadline for when they must leave the U.S. What are their options? What happens to the communities in South Florida that could lose these residents? And a former Miami City ballet dancer uses painting to fill the void after a stroke forced him to stop dancing.
I want to paint all the time. I would love to dance, man.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, tomorrow marks a key day for voters in Miami-Dade County's District 5. That's an area stretching from Little Havana into downtown and South Beach. For the first time in 20 years, the seat has opened up and a diverse mix of candidates are vying for the position. From legacy politicos to a telenovela actor and a progressive former Peace Corps director, voters have an interesting amount of choices. Now, we spoke with the Miami Herald's Doug Hanks about the candidates and the key issues in the race, and I began by asking, how is this special election going to turn out?
There's a new state law that requires candidates for federal office who hold elected office in Florida to resign before they run. And the former commissioner, Bruno Barrero, is running to replace Ileana Ross Layton. He's running the Republican primary. So he had to resign. He didn't resign right away, but he did. The moment the governor signed that bill into law, he resigned, which opened his seat immediately, which required the county commission to either appoint a temporary successor or call a special election. They called a special election.
And how much is this special election costing the county?
At least $500,000, but it could be $1 million because they might need a second election. There's four candidates, and for it to be over on Tuesday, one candidate has to win more than 50% of the vote. If nobody does, the top two finishers face each other in a runoff 2 weeks later.
All right, we're going to look at all four candidates, but of course, one of them is his wife, and did his dropping out early give her any advantage in this race?
Yeah, I mean, that's the presumption that as the one candidate who had the inside information, that candidate, Sarada Barrera, would be ready to roll in a sort of a shotgun election, a very fast campaign with high name recognition, the same last name as the commissioner's held for the seat for 20 years, would be in a better position to win. And also would give challengers who've got some name recognition just less time to make this decision. Like, should I go or should I not?
Bruno Barrero was in office for 20 years. How is his wife distinguishing herself from the political shadow of her husband?
I would say she's not trying very hard to distinguish herself from her husband. When we had our time with the campaign, he was there. She, one of her main messages, who knows the district better than me, because I've been with my husband for all these events. I know the constituents through him. And, you know, I asked her, tell me a vote that you gave your husband a hard time for. She said there were some, but I'm not going to tell you which ones.
Okay. In terms of fundraising and name recognition, Alex Della Portilla is neck and neck with Barrero. What do we know about his time in the state Senate and how that's going to play out?
Well, that's certainly the heart of his campaign. My time in the Senate should qualify me as a good commissioner. And he does get credit. He's sort of been branded as someone who's down and dirty when it comes to campaigning. But he says, hey, listen, I became the majority leader in the Senate. You know, I was elected by my colleagues in the Senate to a leadership post. That suggests that I'm someone who's very good at getting along with people. And he does get credit when Florida's getting ready to cut off funding for the Miami-Port Tunnel as saving that deal. Even people who aren't fans of him said that he played a central role in that.
Can you talk about Della Portilla's connection to the American Dream Mall that was just passed by the commission on Thursday?
Yeah, well, his brother, who's also a politician and a former state senator and a former county commissioner, Miguel Diaz-de-la-Portilla, he's the top lobbyist for Triple Five, which is the developer of American Dream Miami. And so that's the connection. Now, Alex has said that if he wins, he won't vote on anything that involves any of his brother's clients.
All right, Delaportilla is coming up with some baggage into this race. Tell me a little bit about some of his past that's also following him around.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's run for office in the past, and this has gotten attention. His strange wife at the time accused him of sort of a stalking incident where he was in her house, or I guess their shared house, but she was living there at the time. He has a foreclosure in his residence underway as we speak, which he blames on a messy divorce. There was a time where he was kind of getting rowdy in a hotel room in Boston that resulted in an arrest. He blows them off as well, I didn't do anything wrong in each individual circumstance, and also says, by the way, this all gets sort of dug up, I guess, because he is such a lightning rod for people who don't want him to come into office.
Look at another candidate, Eileen Higgins, the only progressive running in this District 5 seat. Who is she and what's her background?
I would say the standout of her background, she used to be a Peace Corps director in Belize. She's a relatively new Miami resident, I think moved to town about 5 years ago. But she's very involved in community groups kind of on the left side of county government. She's been very involved in sort of this county project to promote gun violence reduction. She was at the morgue at one point researching that. That's through the PACT group. She was president of the Downtown Democrats. She was involved in a group that studied the Miami-Dade County budget last year, and this is a group that's kind of been pushing a progressive agenda of like climate change preparations and mandatory workforce housing. At least that's sort of the circle that she's involved in with these community groups.
Where does she stand on key issues, criminal justice, transportation? Does she have any one big issue that she's really holding on to most?
Well, she's very involved. I mean, has been very involved in sort of gun control, that piece, violence reduction, certainly affordable housing. Getting into the race, she was not well known, but because of her position, she had kind of a built-in constituency on the left side of county politics. She's been endorsed by Danielle Levine Cava, the Miami-Dade County Commissioner, who's a leading Democrat, the Sierra Club, because of her environmental views.
But how is she going to fare in a district that's dominated by the Hispanic vote?
Well, first of all, I don't know. But second of all, I mean, Bruna Barrera obviously is a Republican. Democrats do outnumber Republicans in that district. It's of the three categories, you know, no party affiliation, Republican and Democrats. Democrats are number one. And so I would, you know, but for sure, the more conservative side of the district, sort of the Little Havana area, is considered the heart of it and what's going to decide the race. But if one of those candidates gets 50%, it's a simple thing to predict. But when it gets into, well, maybe it's a fight for second place, and then how will that play out in the runoff? It's very complicated. Lots of things can happen.
We're talking with the Miami Herald's Doug Hanks about tomorrow's election in Miami-Dade County's District 5 seat. This is the area that stretches from Little Havana downtown and into South Beach, and this is a position that has a major role in shaping policy. It's the first time in 20 years this seat has been open. There are four candidates vying for that spot. If there's a wild card in the race, it is Carlos Guerin.
Right. TV performer, for sure. You know, I don't think he's well known, but he does have legitimate television credits, and he has generally, I would say, kept a low profile. Know, maybe that's not correct, but like he didn't come to the Miami Herald when it had its editorial board meeting, which is generally a good time for exposure. He did show up for the America TV television debate. Zoraida Barrero did not. So the other three candidates did. And he's a very conservative candidate trying to go for more conservative voters. And this is his first time in politics.
Yeah, you talk about that television debate. The only candidate who didn't show up was the wife of the incumbent, Barrera. Why not?
Well, she told us at the Miami Herald editorial board, I'm happy there aren't cameras running. I'm not a public speaker. So that was an unusual thing for a candidate to say, but I think does capture her strategy of, you know, not looking for high-profile moments. She says she likes the retail politicking better.
And did we learn anything that we didn't already know about the candidates, those who did show up to the television debate?
Oh, I think I'm sure, of course. But what is, you know, I mean, it's hard to say what are the issues that are going to drive this. I mean, to be honest, what people think is going to drive this is how effective will the campaigns be in sort of rustling up mail-in ballots, right? I mean, that is really how these things go with these low, low turnout elections that get very little attention anyway. A lot of people say, hey, the race is done because you can look at a fairly high volume of mail-in ballots, which the candidates have a very good way of sort of controlling, right? I mean, they are the ones who get the ballots essentially distributed to these voters. They have a sense of this person's going to vote for me, and it's very organization, to the point that the election day, it's kind of an asterisk, kind of an extra.
What do you think is going to be the big issue, though, that voters are really caring about most?
I mean, I really think the big issue is am I going to vote or not, really? I mean, in terms of, like, can you organize your campaign well enough to get a ballot in front of this voter? Because that voter's going to be more disposed to vote for you. But I guess traffic, when you look at what the campaigns are talking about, it's definitely housing, traffic, sort of the umbrella category of prosperity, and also very much, does your county government represent you? Or is your county commission just a captive to special interests? I mean, that's a huge, huge theme.
For people who are unfamiliar with the Miami-Dade County Commission, can you just speak briefly on the role these individuals play in shaping the economics and the politics and life in South Florida?
Sure. It's a 13-member county commission. It's very powerful. And every address in the county is part of one district. And in many ways, that district commissioner will serve as a mayor in the areas that are outside city limits. But they also control a lot of funding, or at least have sort of tacit approval of some funding. So once you get in office, it's very hard to remove them, although now they're term limited to 8 years. But it's a big, big deal. And to have an open seat is very rare.
And again, that was the Miami Herald's Doug Hanks. We will have a list of polling places for tomorrow's District 5 special election listed on our website, WLRN.org. Now, on a separate note, we've got a segment for you tomorrow. We want your input on robocalls. You know those automated calls you get to your cell with a machine on the other end. And, well, they're happening in the billions across the United States. And we're going to speak with a Florida lawmaker tomorrow about what's being done to slow robocalls. And we want to hear from you. What's your robocall story? Have you or a family member been scammed by a robocaller? Text the word sundial to 63735. Again, sundial to the number 63735. Or you can email us sundial at WLRNnews. That's 2Ns.org. All right, still to come, another group of immigrants have lost their temporary protected status. What happens to them now? Are you part of a group that's lost your TPS? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. We'd like to hear from you. That's next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, in less than a year, the federal government has ended temporary protected status for immigrants from six different countries. TPS is a protection for people who've emigrated to the United States in the wake of humanitarian disasters. Hundreds of thousands of people who've lost their TPS include people from Sudan, Haiti, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Nepal, and now Honduras. These Hondurans will lose their protection by January of 2020. And we're joined now by Anna Quiros, an attorney with Catholic Legal Services here in Miami. Anna, great to have you back.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right. So first of all, I mean, tell us about the Honduran community here in South Florida that you know of.
Well, the people that we have been seeing, and by that I mean the people that I've been seeing under a program that is called New American Defender Program at Catholic Legal Services, we've seen people out in the community, and many of those people happen to be Hondurans, as well as some other TPS holders. And what we have seen is that some people are, they're just, of course, very scared. They are scared about what's going to happen to them after they lose their status.
You know, we talk, I mean, you've been on the program after Haitians lost their TPS, after Salvadorans lost their TPS. In that time since we've last spoken, I mean, are you getting a lot of calls or people coming to you because now they've got to figure out, well, what to do? Each one of these groups has a different deadline. When that deadline comes, well, you have to go. But are you getting a lot of calls, or are people just so scared that they're hiding and they don't even know what to do next?
It's a mixed bag depending on the community that we are at. And, you know, sometimes we're in Homestead. Some other times we might be out in the Immokalee area. So it really just depends on the immigrant community that we're visiting. But it is a mixed bag. I have seen people that have not come out, where we know that there's so many TPS holders that do need a lot of help. So what we do is we encourage people through Know Your Rights presentations to remind them that, you know, just because you have TPS status, that doesn't mean that's the end of the road for them. In some cases, they might be able to adjust their status through family members.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. We'd love to hear from you. If you or a family member has been in the United States under this TPS, now that it's over, what are those conversations like? Or maybe you know someone who is, and what's the conversation like? What's happening next? You know, where are you turning to? Again, 800-743-9576. You can always find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, or if you want, you could tweet us a quick response at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. We should note the historical context for many of the Hondurans holding TPS status in 1998. Tens of thousands of Hondurans came to the United States after Hurricane Mitch devastated the Central American country. So a whole generation of these immigrants have lived almost their entire lives in the United States. You know, Anna, what do you hear about people who, because the government, the federal government is now saying to them, like they said to the Haitians, like they said to all the other groups that they've ended TPS for, it's okay for you to go back now. But what do you hear about, what are people saying about why they can't go back to Honduras?
So Honduran nationals, what they're saying is that they cannot go back to Honduras because there is a systematic pattern of gang violence in Honduras as we speak. And part of the reason that they're saying that is that because of what's going on in Honduras, and it has been happening a few years ago now, that the gangs have gotten so much power in Honduras that they are pretty much a de facto government. So we're seeing also an exodus of Honduran children coming into the United States, and Hondurans that have been here under the TPS status are very concerned, with very reasonable fear of being concerned that they're going to have problems once they go back to Honduras because these gangs are in their neighborhoods.
What's the advice that you can give any of these folks? What are you telling them about their options? What are their options?
Right. So if a TPS holder comes in front of me for a consultation, I obviously have to look at the case. Every case is different. So it really depends on the facts, and it's on a case-by-case basis what I tell them. But there are some general things that I will be able to see and tell them. For example, if they can adjust through a family member, I encourage that the family member, if it's a resident spouse, become a U.S. citizen. And then in certain scenarios, I could even advise a person to travel out of the country under an immigration application called advanced parole and then come back in and adjust status. If they're living here in Florida, I could also tell them, look, if you have a family member and you're afraid to leave and you can't adjust status because you were never admitted here, you can move to a circuit that may be able to treat TPS as an admission. And though there are two circuits in the United States, and those are the Sixth and the Ninth Circuits. And they, you know, if you're in that jurisdiction, you might be able to adjust your status if you have a family member.
The other thing, too, we were talking about this just before the program,
because it crossed my mind that, you know, some of these folks coming from Latin American countries, especially, the legal system in their countries is very different. And there's one thing you pointed out that I want to make sure we mention is that in some of these countries, there is a certain type of person they usually go to for legal advice. That person is?
That is exactly what we were talking about, is a notario. Many TPS holders go to a notario or a person that doesn't have a license to practice law to get TPS applications done. And in many situations, when I review these applications, there could be inconsistencies in the application or omissions, or the truth is not put into the application, and this is done by a notario, and the person doesn't know English, so they don't really know any better, and it becomes apparent that there's inconsistencies, because when I'm talking to the person, they're telling me one set of facts, and then I'm seeing a different set of facts laid out in the application.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Maybe you're in education, and you've seen you have children in your classes or in schools, you know, whose parents were here under the TPS. What are some of the concerns that they have? What are the things that you're hearing from them? How is this impacting families? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Again, 800-743-9576. Let me go to the phones. I've got Rob in Fort Lauderdale. Rob, you're an employer, and so this is hitting you directly.
Yeah, you know, we employ about 400 advanced roofing, advanced green technologies. We have 24 Haitians, Hondurans, and Salvadorans. Some of them, three of them are foremen. They've trained other U.S. citizens, and we actually went up to Washington, D.C. as the National Roofing Contractors Association 6 weeks ago with 400 contractors from across the country and pleaded our case, you know, that they do something about legal immigration and the people that have that TPS status. Because, you know, I brought up one of my Haitian foremen, and he's got five kids that are U.S. citizens, and I just can't imagine sending him back and what happens to the kids. So
what would
we really need help.
If when the status ends for all these different groups and Haitians have until next year, again, as I mentioned, Hondurans until early January 2020. When this all ends and these folks have to leave, what happens to you?
We can't replace these people. We cannot replace them. It's this big myth that, you know, they're displacing U.S. citizens. And we started a three-year apprenticeship program for roofing professionals, you know, $16, $18, $20 an hour after the third year. And we have to go out and recruit to get new blood into this apprenticeship program. We advertise across the country. And it's not just roofing. It's all construction jobs. We need help. Our business will diminish when we start losing these people.
So just, Rob, if I may, you mean you can't find Americans to do those jobs?
That is correct. And we can't even find them to train them, where we have the first state-approved roofing apprenticeship program with the Associated Building Contractors, and it's just we're not getting the young ones to come in there. You know, one of the things in my industry, you know, half of the people are afraid of heights. They won't go up a ladder, and that eliminates a pretty good workforce. And then, you know, the heat and everything else. So it's something that U.S. citizens, it's not on the top of their list to do.
And I wonder what kind of conversations you are having with these workers, because now they got to start planning and preparing for that day and what they're going to do. I mean, it could be a lot of things. Some may decide to stay illegally. Others will have to leave. What sort of things are you hearing, and what are you telling them?
Yeah, well, we're giving them as much help as we can legally and whatever resources we have. But again, you know, if they do stay, we do e-verify. And then when I went up and spoke to, you know, the legislators, I'm like, hey, you know, give these guys a path to legal citizen. We need them. And maybe, you know, give priority to the guys that use e-verify to make sure they have their legal workforce. But, you know, it's just, I don't want to talk politics, but it's humane, unhumane, what this whole thing is about.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for calling and letting us know, and obviously a story that we're going to keep following. And again, there is still time before a lot of this TPS ends for different groups, but, you know, it's going to have an impact on the community as well as families. Rob, again, thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
He brings up a lot of interesting points, Anna. We talked about this before as well. These are folks who they're in the community. They are working full time, going to school, running businesses. What kind of things do you hear from people? And I want to know what you're telling them about the fact that they may have to just let all that go. And you're talking about property. You're talking about businesses. You're talking about a lot that they have to just. Some things they may be able to take, a lot of it they're going to have to leave behind.
Yes, that is very true. I did want to just point out that with this particular person that he's talking about that has U.S. citizen children, that it's very likely that these children are very, very young. And under immigration law, a parent of a U.S. citizen could adjust status if they have been admitted or paroled in. However, if the children are very young or they're toddlers or under the age of 10, we're talking about an adjustment that is going to be happening 11 years from now or so. And that's where the real problem is that that person's not going to be able in certain circumstances, unless he adjusts some other way or gets residency through some other way or protection from some other manner, that he's going to have to not get deported in 11 years from now.
Just real quickly explain that what you mean when you're talking about adjust.
When I say adjust status, I mean from, you know, when people come in or let's say you come in on a tourist visa, for example, and you overstay your visa. If you're a parent of a U.S. citizen and that U.S. citizen child is, let's say, over 21 years old, that child can petition for you and you can become a resident. But that child has to be over 21 years old. So in that scenario, I imagine that this gentleman has very young children, and imagine the prospect of having to wait it out for 11 years with this type of climate.
Yeah, but I was also wondering that the process that you were just describing, usually how long does it take?
Oh, once you file the application,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It could take over a year. It could take over a year.
So you're adding that on top of the fact that you're waiting for your kids to get to that age.
Yes.
The other thing that we heard too from Rob is that, he can't replace a lot of these workers. So with their skill set and with everything that they have, I mean, what have you been told, or what have you heard from people about where they're going next? What are they going to do next? Will they try to stay, even if it's illegal? Will they just go back home? Will they go to a different country?
Right. So I have heard that some people said that they were just going to stay. And normally when I do the consultation, I don't hear that response. And I think that they're just being very prudent, or just they're not trying to tell me, well, I'm just going to stay and I don't care what you're saying. But as an attorney, I always tell them to abide by the law, and that whatever decision is a personal decision if they do decide to stay. My job is to give them the legal tools to be able to stay here if they can, and if they can't, to at least give them some expectation or guidance as to what to do next. So if somebody doesn't have any relief right now, what I suggest to them is come back in 6 months, or come back whenever you think something has changed, because immigration law and the procedures are changing so quickly that it's very risky to not see an attorney for a year, I would say. So somebody's situation can completely change from day to night if they don't take action within months.
And is there an outreach program? Is there a way to reach? Because as you said, you got folks who don't speak English, and even if they've been here a long time, their world is small. They only know this one little area. It's work, school, whatever, their community. They may not know everything about the systems that we have in place here in the United States. So they may not know. They may not be listening to this program right now. So they don't even know you're here talking about what you might be able to offer. But is there an outreach program to try to get to these communities and say, well, look, at least you have somebody you can consult with?
Yes. So under the New American Defender Program at Catholic Legal Services, I'm going to give out this number. It's 305-373-1073, extension 1218. You can get information about where our next screening clinic is. And we have pretty much laid out like the whole year for to be able to serve people and be able to give them a free legal consultation.
Again, I'm talking with Anna Quito. She's an attorney with Catholic Legal Services here in Miami, and we are discussing that another group has lost their TPS, their temporary protected status. This time it is Hondurans. So far in the past year, in the past 12 months, we've seen people from Sudan, Haiti, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Nepal, and now Honduras lose that status. The Hondurans now will lose this protection. The final deadline is January of 2020. Again, we'd love to hear from you if maybe you are here under TPS. What are your what are you doing now to prepare for that deadline, for the end? What comes next for you? Or if you work with any folks who are here under TPS, you're in education, you've seen kids whose parents are here under TPS, we'd love to hear your thoughts. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Anna, does ICE have the ability, immigration officials, do they have the ability to detain or deport immigrants that remain here once that status has been removed?
Yes. So there's a group of TPS holders, for example, that were in court proceedings. And once they got the TPS status, those court proceedings have been administratively closed. I don't know if you've heard of a case that came out last week. It's called Matter of Castro Tum, where the Attorney General Sessions actually overruled a case called Avetisyan, and another case, Matter of WYO. And what he said was that that administrative closure needed to be used rarely. He overruled those two cases. And so what's happening is that ICE is going to have even a stronger argument to put cases back onto the court's docket. And people who may have, you know, of course, once TPS ends, people that have their cases administratively closed, either party could move to put those cases back on calendar.
So, I mean, you see situations like that. Do you think that a lot of people are just going to go underground? They're just going to hide. They're not leaving.
With news like this, I would hope that people would just reach out more to immigration attorneys and not notarios. But I just think that they're probably feeling very singled out, and that they would probably want to go hide.
What are you telling folks about if they have property, they own a business at this point, they have to leave it behind?
I would say, powers of attorney. So hopefully in the family context, there would be a U.S. citizen, a child that could take care of the property. And then things could be taken care of that way. But in a lot of situations, the families may not have somebody. So they would have to seek out somebody that they could trust. And then if it falls on the hands of an unscrupulous person, that's just very, very sad and awful.
Let me turn this on you, though, this way. Obviously there are folks who are going to say, and you've heard it, like, we owe these folks nothing. You know, we don't owe them anything. And there's a system of laws and people must follow the law. And so if your status is over, sorry, but that's it. You've got to go. What does this country owe any of them?
I would say it owes them due process. You've let people come here and stay here for many, many, many years. We've given people the chance to buy property, use credit cards, establish a life here. I think that they would be owed more than just, you have a year to leave. It sounds like it's a long time, but in reality, if you've been here for 20 years, a year may not even be enough to be able to really leave in a safe and legal manner.
The other thing, too, is I'm curious if you've seen any funding impacted for, you know, your organization since we've heard all of this anti-immigrant rhetoric that's popped up since the 2016 election. Have you seen any impact, you know, in support for your services?
Yes. Under the New American Defender Program, we're really lucky because it's privately funded by a foundation called, or a partnership coalition called IMPAC. And Mike Fernandez is one of the, he is the funder of this program, and he has a strong vested interest in helping the South Florida community. And so this is what, this is the reason why this program exists.
All right. I want to try to squeeze in a couple of phone calls here if I can. Let me go to Rudy. I've got Rudy in Fort Lauderdale. Rudy, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you guys?
I'm good. Rudy, do you have TPS status?
I do have TPS status, and I am in shock. And, you know, I'm a dreamer and a TPS beneficiary. My first language is English. I speak Spanish, but it's not really my main language. America is the only thing I know. It's the only thing I've ever loved. I don't even know anything about my country, Honduras. I have no idea if I have to go back there what I'm going to face, because I don't know it.
Ever since the news came out that Honduran TPS was over, I mean, at that point, I'm just, what are the things that you've been thinking about and talking about with people to figure out what your next step is?
Well, I've been praying a lot. That's the main thing. I'm asking God to solve this somehow, that he's pretty much the only one that can actually solve this. But I've been, you know, constantly talking to lawyers. I've been most likely going to try to get the route of getting an employment-based visa. I'm hoping that might be a route. So I already spoken to a couple of my employers, and I have one of them that's willing to take this mantle on themselves to finally sponsor me. But it's, again, there's more legal issues behind that. Is there going to be a visa for me at the end of the day for that? I don't know. So preparing wise, it's scary. I don't really know what I'm going to do.
Rudy, do me a favor. I'm going to put you on hold here for a second because we want to chat with you in just a moment, because I do have to, unfortunately, end this segment. Anna Kiros, real quickly, that number that you had, could you give it back out again?
It's 305-373-1073, extension 1218.
And we'll put that up on our Facebook as well at WLRN Sundial. So if you have any questions, Anna Kiros, again, attorney with Catholic Legal Services here in Miami, and a story that we'll continue to follow. Anna, thank you so much as always.
You're welcome.
All right, still to come, we're going to talk with a former Miami City Ballet dancer. He had a stroke and he lost his ability to dance, but he's finding new expression through painting. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Isa Nusi Garcia Rodriguez is a former Miami City Ballet dancer who suffered a stroke in 2012. After his accident, the right side of his body was paralyzed, unable to dance professionally, but in his recovery, he pushed himself to develop another passion, painting. Today, Rodriguez is opening an exhibit, An Evening of Art with Isa Nusi, Unveiling a Renaissance. The exhibit tells the story of his journey through his rehabilitation. And some of the artwork are ideas from his choreography, and others reflect his Cuban heritage. Now, he's going to present his artwork to the public in the Design District tonight, starting at 7 p.m., Now, he's married to current Miami City Ballet dancer Christy Nicole Garcia, and this weekend we visited the exhibit while he and his wife, his team, and him were setting up the artwork. And we started by talking about the days and months after Isa Nusi's stroke and how he found himself moving toward the canvas.
After he had his accident, I wanted to understand some of the recovery and what that was like, because you spend your life trying to become great at something, and now all of a sudden it's not there anymore. And I want to know your thoughts too, is what that conversation is like when you know that the life you know has to change and you have to go in a different direction. What was that like for you, for both of you?
That's not easy. And I always try to steer Isa in the positive direction, to think about the things that he has, because the doctor said that maybe he wouldn't walk, or maybe he, let's just put it this way, that he said most likely he wouldn't survive, and if he did, his quality of life wouldn't be maybe good enough to want to survive. So just to think about how lucky that he is to be able to do everything he can do, and to look the way that he looks, and to be able to paint and dance a little bit and do and live.
But someday, so. Someday I'm going to dance. Someday I will dance. I have my hair that I get like that sometimes, how you say?
A seizure.
But I don't care. Of course, I would love to dance.
So in the recovery process, when did you start painting? ¿Cuándo empezaste a pintar? And why? ¿Por qué?
After that, I come from the hospital. I went to my apartment and I couldn't talk. So that is when I start to talk to Chrissy, please. Can you pour me my canvas? But when I even talk, I was like, come here. I just want for my choreography. I said, like, is I don't understand. So please, if you can say, I put it with the canvas. Anyway, I start painting. And then she was like in the forest in the morning. She's like, what are you doing? I said, like, look, this one. So I start doing that one, that painting there. That was with choreografías.
You guys were talking through painting.
Yes, in a way. He was really frustrated that he couldn't dance, and he didn't, I think he felt he had no way to express himself. And one day he just started painting again. So
he had always been painting?
Yes. Since I've known him, he's painted. Since he was a little boy, he's painted for fun. But after his accident, it's become way bigger in his life.
Now take me to that first time he did paint to talk to you, and what was going on at that point?
Actually, the painting's not here right now, but it's the one with the brain. It's the painting of the dancer with the brain. Remember, that was your first one. It's not here. But it's a painting of a brain that has a bunch of little sections, and it has all of these memories in it. And I would say that was the first. I feel like he was trying to tell me, like, I remember all of these things. And I think.
So this one is the one that I put in my head, in mi cabeza. Is because I said, like, please, I want to do all my choreografía, not just for my choreografía. I think in my head they come with the right in my head, you know? So se fue para la derecha. Y por eso yo decía que todos los bailarines venían.
I'm looking at this painting, and I see you, and the left side is just you dancing, or at least in a very powerful pose, and the right side is a tree. So basically, that's the side of him that was paralyzed afterwards and that he couldn't move. When you see that, what are you translating? What are you gathering from all this? When you look at his work, what do you see?
I see a story and a timeline in all the paintings, especially now that I see them all out together. I can see different periods of time of his recovery. I can see things that he was feeling in that moment, maybe good things, maybe frustrations, maybe dreams. And like he was talking about before when he made the choreography painting, what he was trying to say was he would dream about it. He would sleep at night and think about it, and then the next day paint what he was thinking.
What I want is that everybody in my painting, I just want that everybody, not for me, is for in his apartment or his life and his house or whatever, looking, and even if you are like that, you just looking and say, like, wow, I love it. This, you know, it's not just like TV. Sometimes it's very good for noticiero and everything, but when you see this pintura, it's like, wow, I love this. This mar, el mar. If I can dance, it's a lot of things. I don't know what to say.
You hope to inspire people.
Yes.
I look at you right now, and you look healthy.
Yeah.
You're moving. You're
One, two, three, four, five.
You're dancing. I mean, well, you move like a dancer. You look really good. You look fantastic. But right now, how do you feel?
Yeah, I doing choreography a long time. Yeah, now too, I did And for Romeo and Julieta, it's like a dance, folklore, teatro. That was too very good too. In my I did painting with coreografía.
With the costumes.
Yeah.
You painted the costumes.
Yeah. Where do you think this is all going to go for you? Is it you're going to stay with your painting? No, do you want to go back to dancing? What do you think is going to happen?
No, no, I want to paint all the time. And I going to do choreography, and I would love to do, I would love to dance, man.
After all this recovery and everything that you've been through, how is life different for you now? For you?
For me? I don't know. At first it was more different, and now it's more normal. So at first, right after his accident, it was really different. We had to go through a whole process all over again to get to know each other again and find ways to communicate with each other. And now it's way more normal. And now we've kind of learned, we have our little groove going. Not to say that it's always super easy. Sometimes we still have our moments that it's difficult to communicate, but I guess we're just normal people.
And I also wondered from you as well, is what message you would have for people? Because again, he spends his life, anyone who spends their life devoted to something and then it's taken away, that's not easy for most of us, but we have to adapt. What's the message you would have for people? Because obviously he's adapted, you've adapted. This is, you know, what would you say to folks about that process?
I would say don't give up and think positive and think about everything that you have. Don't try to, even though it's hard in the moment, try not to dwell on everything you don't have. And that is very difficult. But try to be thankful for what you do have and make the best of it. And I guess that's what I tried to do with Issa all the time. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but try not to be too hard on yourself either and just take it day by day.
You could see the timeline, this whole story of all this work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's the story you would tell people who are coming in to see this for the first time? How they should view it? Where do you start? What is this telling them?
Oh, let's see. I would say my advice would be, as you go around, just to, like Issa said, be inspired. And as you look at the paintings, try to find little things, because every time I look at his work, I see something new. And I feel like maybe it's not the same as what Issa was thinking, but he wants everyone to be inspired when he looks at it. Whatever it is that you gather from it, he just wants you to either be happy or enjoy it, or like he said, if you buy a piece, he hopes that that person wakes up and looks at it and feels inspired each day or finds something from it that you like.
It's just sort of...
And again, I was talking with artist Issa Nusi Rodriguez and his wife, Miami City Ballet dancer Christy Nickel Garcia. There are more details about this art exhibit, which is, again, tonight in the Design District. And we have photos and video on our social media. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Look up WLRN Sundial. And that's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.